Penguin Random House Audio presents A Season for That, Lost and Found in the Other Southern France. This is the author, Steve Hoffman. To Mary Jo, Eva, and Joseph. Sorry this took so long. This book was written over a several-year period, several years after the events themselves. I relied on contemporaneous journals and my own memory to reconstruct the story's scenes and their relationship to one another. I relied on subsequent visits to the same locations to deepen some physical descriptions. Though some dialogue was captured in journals, I reconstructed other conversations to the best of my recollection. All characters are actual people, and all scenes are based on actual events. Throughout, I used the writing process and the narrative that emerged from it as an effort to understand the truth as I felt it of an experience that affected me profoundly and irreversibly. Part 1. 1. What do you think? Asked Mary Jo. About what? About everything, the village. We had just completed our first tour of Otignac, population 800, burrowed deep in rural Languedoc. This was home for the next 6 months. This was where our two kids, Eva, 14, and Joseph, 9, would go to school. This is what we had picked of all the options available. A knife edge of Mediterranean sunlight sliced the central square in two. To our right, in a hot wedge of shade, the white plastic tables and green plastic chairs outside the Café du Commerce were talkatively half-occupied. Two bikes leaned against the nearest table. A pair of men sat across from each other in tight jerseys and half-shorts, with two glasses of white wine sweating on the table between them. I think it's a perfectly beautiful village, I said. It's just not a particularly beautiful village, is all. What's Sesh? Asked Joe. What's what? Sesh. He was pointing to the first of four dishes the Café du Commerce was proposing for lunch. Sesh farci à la cétoise, I said, thoughtfully, as if deciding how best to explain it to him. But I had no idea what a sesh was, nor what the stuffing in a sesh farci might be, nor what it meant to be à la cétoise. I did not know what a gardien was, either, item 2 on the laminated menu, nor, in fact, did I know what number 3 dorade was, or whether it would taste good grillé. I did recognize item number 4, rather a classic, referred to in this part of France, it appeared, as cheeseburger avec frites. The owner of the café, who doubled as the waiter, had a hint of James Dean prettiness, with sandy hair swept back and sandy stubble along a remarkable shelf of jaw. But the bruised hollows around his eyes and his dingy teeth spoke of a pack or two a day, too much coffee, and not enough sleep. Something about our group, whether it was our flushed Nordic skin, our two cameras, or simply the ineffable scent of touriste américain we must have given off in spite of ourselves, something about us had evidently triggered something in him, and his sunken eyes had glared at me as he first approached our table, as if, after all these years, he finally found himself face to face with the bastard who had run off with his wife. Our two kids had received their elementary education at a public school called L'Etoile du Nord French Immersion, where the curriculum had been taught in French. As a result, we had spent a good chunk of the prime of our lives commuting more than an hour a day, 5 days a week, 9 months a year, from a perfectly good suburban school district to the east side of St. Paul, so our kids could speak French like their father. As that era of our lives had drawn to a close, Mary Jo and I had decided that 8 years of Raffi songs, multiplication cards, and French vocabulary quizzes on the morning commute would feel more worthwhile in retrospect were it capped by a semester in France, and we hoped, by some pretty spanking good French emanating from the mouths of our two children. One of the very first things American students of French learn is how to order un coca at a restaurant, although you would not have guessed that from Joe's and Eva's blank and disbelieving stares when I had ordered two beers and invited them, in French, to order their cokes from Monsieur. He had stood there, looking back and forth, apparently as irritated with my turning this into a teachable moment as with their refusal to speak. He returned now, carrying a tray, in T-shirt and Adidas sweats, walking on the collapsed heels of his espadrilles. He set two glasses of Kronenbourg, that ubiquitous, inoffensive, thoroughly quaffable Parisian café standard in front of Mary Jo and me, and poured each of the kids a Coke. "Can you ask for some ice for the kids?" asked Mary Jo. The café owner stood waiting to hear something in his own language. "They never serve ice in France," I said. "Sure they do," she said. "No, they don't," I said. And what I meant was that, sure, you could ask for ice in France, and they might even have some, but it was not normal, and it made you into that person. In my case, the tall American wearing hiking shoes at a table with two cameras on it, speaking English to my family who asked for ice. Nobody wants to be that person. Merci, I said to the owner and smiled. He notched the serving tray under his armpit and stalked off. Eva took a sip. It's warm, she said. It's not warm, it's cool, I said. It is warm, said Joe. It's not warm. It's not a 32-ounce Slurpee, but it's not warm. This is what I was talking about, said Mary Jo. Weren't we literally just talking about this? Guys, we're in France, I said. Things are going to be different. That's part of why we're here. The church bell rang out the noon hour as I took a sip of beer. Across from us, the doors of a municipal library stood open, blasted by sunshine. I tried leaning back in my plastic chair, then feeling a suspicious amount of give, sat back up. The talk around us was blessedly free of the English, German, Swedish, and Dutch that seem to breed in those popular places that are in the process of changing or have already changed from themselves into painted and tourist-hungry imitations of themselves. But the French I was hearing was a rapid-fire sing-song that sounded more Spanish or Italian in many ways than French. And despite the near French fluency on which I had long prided myself, I struggled to follow much of anything that was said around us. James Dean returned and stood hip-shot beside our table, as if resigned to get through this cruddy little episode so he could resume staining his teeth with dark roast and tar. I asked him what a gardien was, and he explained that it was like a daube de boeuf, but made with the meat of bulls from the Camargue. I think I had a notion at that point of what a daube de boeuf was, a beef stew, red wine, but my awareness of it was like my awareness of haggis or stockfish or krumkake, something exceptionally regional and distant, more tradition than food. And what was sèche farci, I wondered. He puffed his cheeks and blew. It was a fruit of the sea, like an encorné. My blank smile revealed that I did not know what an encorné was any more than a sèche, and as he absently described a stuffing made of breadcrumbs, sausage, and aromatics, he scanned the tables surrounding us and skipped over to a bald man in a track suit, sitting by the door, confiscated his partially eaten plate, and placed it under my nose. Sèche farci, said the waiter. On the plate were 2.5 ghostly white inflated ovoids smothered in tomato sauce. The half-eaten one resembled the ivory-colored stomach of a good-sized largemouth bass that had been stuffed tight with bratwurst, and the steam rising into my face was a rich perfume of mingled tomato, sausage, onion, garlic, and saltwater pear. Some kind of shellfish? I asked Mary Jo, as the waiter returned the plate to its rightful owner. Squid? She asked. The waiter returned now to display a whole fish, like a huge bronze sunfish, branded with grill marks. Dorade, he said, and swept away again as the attention of our fellow diners gravitated toward us. He returned once more with a plate from the baker's table, and whether knowingly insulting or simply thorough, explained to us that the meat patty with melted cheese on it, sandwiched between two slices of brioche, was a cheeseburger. I will take the sèche farci, I said when the waiter had rejoined us. Despite my introvert's tendency towards social reticence, I was and always had been a broad-minded and rather swashbuckling eater, willing to find room in my heart and my palate for anything that any fraction of the human population had at some time found to be edible fare. I asked the kids in French what they would like. They sat uncomfortably for a second or two, and Joe looked imploringly at Mary Jo. Dad, said Eva. Stevie, said Mary Jo. What? I asked. You know what they want. Just order it. And for you, madame? Asked the waiter. Mary Jo appeared for a time willing to wait me out. Madame? Asked the waiter. Cheeseburger avec frites, said Mary Jo in unselfconscious American franglais. We are not eating cheeseburgers, I said. The kids both nodded at her. Mary Jo held up three fingers. Trois, she said, and the waiter nodded. And, said Mary Jo, she pointed to the kids' glasses. Glass, she asked. He nodded again and disappeared through the stone doorway into the cafe. I've got an idea, I said. Let's ask if they have Doritos. It's the first day, she said. Give the kids a break. I took another sip of beer, attempted to lean back again and change my mind. Joe, let's go check out the library, I said. It turned out to be a short visit. The library is closed, monsieur, said a 50-ish woman in wire spectacles and a sleeveless blouse. My apologies, the doors were open, I said. The doors are open, but according to the sign, we are closed at noon, therefore we are closed. It's closed, I said, when we were back at the table. The doors are wide open, said Mary Jo. The door.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?